I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The upcoming election, which is just 11 days away, is expected to cost $4 billion, the most expensive midterms ever, according to data from the Center for Responsive Politics. So who's following the money, especially from outside spending and super PACs? On Saturday, the Supreme Court issued an order allowing Texas to enforce its photo ID law at the polls. The law is the strictest in the nation. Supporters say the law is needed to cut down on voter fraud, but studies show only two Texans were convicted of impersonating others at the polls over the past 10 years, just two voters in 10 years. So how should the media deal with voter fraud claims when it doesn't really exist? And what about voter disenfranchisement? 34 states have passed laws requiring voters to show some form of ID at the polls. And just last week, the 48-year-old San Francisco Bay Guardian shut down. It came as a shock just 2 weeks before the election. What does this mean for investigative reporting, and what is in store for alternative weeklies? Joining us on today's Media Roundtable are three guests. Dave Leventhal is a senior political reporter at the Center for Public Integrity. His latest piece is called Super PACs Exploit Disclosure Loophole. Last-minute registration means groups may hide donors until after Election Day. Hi, Dave. Welcome back to the show.
Good to be back with you.
Great to have you. And Mike Doyle is a reporter in the D.C. Bureau of McClatchy Newspapers. Mike is legal affairs correspondent for McClatchy. His latest piece is about the ID law in Texas. He also has a piece called Legal Questions Loom in Blackwater Convictions, and we'll talk with him about that later in the show. Hi, Mike. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, good to be back.
Good to have you. And Tim Redmond is former San Francisco Bay Guardian editor. He was at The Guardian for 31 years. Tim is the founder of 48 Hills, a progressive daily online paper where you can read original reporting and investigative reporting. And Tim's latest piece is called, Is the Left in SF Dead? No. And Tim joins me in studio. Hi, Tim. Great to see you.
Hi. Happy to be here again.
Great to have you. So as we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we start off by highlighting good journalism. Dave Leventhal with the Center for Public Integrity, what did you see this week? What stood out for you?
Of course, the news about Ebola has been all the rage in media circles. Pretty much every publication that is writing news is writing about Ebola in some form or fashion. I was really taken by a piece that the Texas Tribune, which is a nonprofit news organization based out of Austin, Texas, wrote. It was a fascinating chronicle of the political, bureaucratic, public health, and medical system mishaps that occurred in Dallas, Texas. I worked in Dallas for the Dallas Morning News for 7 years, so it certainly caught my eye, having had a connection to the city. And it really talked in a great deal, not only about the mishaps, but also the different powers that Texas officials did not use in attempting to either control or ameliorate the situation of a man coming to Texas, coming to Dallas, and contracting Ebola. He ultimately died, and the piece went into great detail to talk about potential travel restrictions that the state could have put in place, various health quarantines, and ultimately it was an investigative piece that on a very short turnaround was able to provide Texas readers and readers all across the country and the world with information that I simply didn't see in any other publication elsewhere outside of that one article.
So are officials in Texas making major changes as a result of this?
They appear to do so. At the very least, Governor Rick Perry has set in motion, spooled forward a commission that's going to investigate exactly what went wrong during that situation there, a situation that, as you well know, is still unfolding by virtue of two healthcare workers who had dealt with the man who ultimately died from Ebola in Dallas. They're recovering right now. So there does seem to be a great deal of hand-wringing and second-guessing that's taking place right now, where officials of all sorts are wondering, what did we do wrong and what can we do in the future to make this better, particularly if there are other people in Texas that contract Ebola.
And that is Dave Leventhal, senior political reporter with the Center for Public Integrity. What about you, Mike? Mike Doyle is a legal affairs correspondent with McClatchy. What really stood out for you this week?
A story by an author who I don't even particularly like is worth reading. The author is Jeffrey Toobin. He's the legal affairs correspondent for the New Yorker magazine. He has a piece called The Obama Brief, and it's essentially access journalism using his own stature. Toobin talked to the president and put into context the president's legal legacy that he's leaving with the court nominees, as well as the legal challenges he's faced on the Affordable Care Act and others. It's, as always with Toobin, it's a well-told story, a lot of intelligence, his own legal experience brought to bear. And if you want to get a good handle on President Obama and the law, this is a piece to read.
And what did he come up with, just quickly? What will the legacy be?
Well, the biggest legacy may well be the appellate court nominees. The president has, as every president does over the course of several years in office, put his stamp on the not just trial-level courts, but more importantly, the appellate levels. These are the courts below the level of the Supreme Court, but that nonetheless vote on the majority of appeals in the country. And in some particularly important circuits like Washington, D.C., a majority of appellate judges are now Obama appointees. They have lifetime tenure. They'll be interpreting the Constitution and statutes for years to come.
Hmm. All right. Well, thank you for that one from The New Yorker. That's Mike Doyle, legal affairs correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers, and Tim Redmond, former San Francisco Bay Guardian editor and founder of 48 Hills. What about you? What did you see this week that you liked?
Well, I'm going to go local here. I'm going to talk locally because, of course, everybody's been writing about the demise of my former employer, the San Francisco Bay Guardian. And what I found particularly intriguing this week was a piece by a reporter named Joe Eskenazi in the SF Weekly. And I mention him because Joe and I have been journalistically at war for years. We don't see San Francisco and politics in the same way at all. And in fact, we have argued and fought bitterly over San Francisco politics in the pages of our respective papers. We were tough competitors for many, many years. And his piece on the shutdown of The Guardian was actually very nice and well-reported and showed that he, while we were foes, he respected us and what we were trying to do. And he also acknowledged in his piece that part of what happened was his former employer, Village Voice Media, when they owned SF Weekly, was so intent on putting us out of business that they essentially put both papers out of business, that they cut rates so low that they made it impossible for either alternative Newsweekly to make a profit. And, of course, they were owned by a big chain, so they could absorb the losses. The Guardian was not. But, you know, putting it in that context, and as I say, a nice piece from someone who rarely had anything nice to say about the Bay Guardian or me, shows that, you know, all of us across the spectrum really feel terrible when a newspaper goes out of business, that it's more than just, did you agree with The Guardian? Did you like its politics? The Guardian was a newspaper, and I think a lot of us in this business feel the death of any newspaper is a tragedy.
Hmm. All right, so kudos to the San Francisco Weekly for covering the closure of the San Francisco Bay Guardian. Tim Redmond spent 31 years at The Guardian. He's founder of 48 Hills, a progressive daily online newspaper. And we will put links to these stories at yourcallradio.org. And so let's talk about the closure of The Guardian. I don't know if you've been following this, Dave or Mike, but the San Francisco Bay Guardian is an institution in this town. It's been around for 48 years. They've done incredible investigative work. So many people were shocked because it's 2 weeks before the election when it shut down. The employees didn't know it was coming. Their emails were shut down without the bosses telling them. So, Dave, what are your thoughts on the closure of an alternative weekly like this in a town like San Francisco?
Sad, but it's not surprising. I've been to San Francisco many times. If there's one city in the United States among maybe a handful of others that seems to still have a very robust, very lively, engaging media culture, it's San Francisco. So on one hand, it is surprising, even shocking. On the other hand, it really isn't, because any city that you go to pretty much across the country again, you're finding all weeklies, if they still exist, struggling mightily. The ones that still exist are shadows of their former selves in terms of funding, in terms of staffing. Yes, there are exceptions to the rule, but in most major cities, they're just not what they used to be because of the realities of the media landscape that we're in right now, where it's just that much more difficult for alt-weeklies to make a profit and therefore hire staff and do good journalism and put out a quality product week to week or day to day.
And Mike, in addition to covering legal issues, you also cover California politics. So what was your response to The Guardian shutting down?
Well, I felt it acutely because I got my own journalism start in the early 1980s at the Palo Alto Weekly and used to read some stories. And I always loved The Guardian. It was and I mean this respectfully, an idiosyncratic paper that was willing to do things that other people were not. I mean, the Brugman took the editor, as I recall, or the publisher, took on issues like public utilities, and he took on things like joint operating agreements at a small paper out in Manteca in the Central Valley that other people would not touch. He was a thumb in the eye to the media establishment and the political establishment as well. The Palo Alto Weekly still exists and is still going strong. I think it's cutting against the grain that Tim spelled out, but I felt very strongly in my heart sadness when I read about The Guardian.
Tim, you brought up the Village Voice Media earlier, and it's really hard to keep up with the owners of these papers. So I just want to mention that the San Francisco Bay Guardian founders, Bruce Brugman and Gene Dibble, sold the San Francisco media company, the publisher of The Examiner and the San Francisco Weekly, the San Francisco Bay Guardian in 2012, right?
Right. So basically now the San Francisco media company, which has gone through a couple of name changes of its own, owns The Examiner and the SF Weekly. And at that, until recently, owned The Guardian, yes.
Okay. And so what was the major decision behind this closure? Some people said, well, why not shut down the San Francisco Weekly rather than The Guardian?
Well, I have to say, I am not privy to the finances. I don't know. I mean, the owners said The Guardian wasn't financially viable. I think the staff disagreed with that. I wasn't there. I didn't see the numbers. I can't tell you whether it was financially viable or not. I can say that, you know, for a while, people have said, well, you own two alternative weeklies that are journalistically certainly competing with each other. The purely capitalist, don't think about community institutions approach is, why do you have two? Why don't you combine them or shut one of them down? Now, obviously, without The Guardian, the SF Weekly will get more ad revenue. So I don't know. I really don't know what played into these people's minds. But I do know that what obviously didn't play in was the concept that the Bay Guardian was not just a newspaper. As your two other guests have said, it wasn't just a newspaper. It was a community institution. It was part of history. And, you know, I feel very sad that that's missing now from San Francisco.
The staffers of The Guardian have launched an Indiegogo campaign to save The Guardian. I mean, one of the main goals is to make sure that the archives don't go anywhere because there are some amazing investigative reports.
Well, there's 48 years worth of San Francisco political history and cultural history. I mean, you think, you go back, The Guardian started in 1966 and was here through the Summer of Love and all of the 60s and then through the 70s and through the 80s and the 90s. I mean, so much happened in San Francisco during that era. And so much of it was progressive politics, progressive culture. The Guardian covered things that nobody else touched. And that's all sitting there in a warehouse in San Francisco owned by the SF Media Company. And I believe that stuff ought to be in a university library somewhere with an archivist who can really take care of it and where it's publicly accessible. I mean, that's something that when I was at The Guardian, when researchers, historians, other journalists came in and said, what did The Guardian write about this in 1974? Or, you know, well, how was The Guardian covering Harvey Milk when he first ran for office? Mm-hmm. I said, well, we got the archives. Come on in and look. I mean, I tried to make that publicly accessible, and that's what it needs to be.
Well, I emceed an event, Save the Guardian, a couple days ago, and Tom Amiona spoke and said, at one point, all the other papers treated me as a freak, and the only paper to take me seriously was the San Francisco Bay Guardian.
Right, and that's what we did. And, it was not only politics, but arts and culture. I mean, we covered arts and culture that nobody else covered. And we discovered bands and performers when they were small time who then went big time. And as I say, all of that stuff is really critical historical record. So it's really important that that not be lost.
Tim Redmond is former San Francisco Bay Guardian editor. He was there for 31 years, and we got a surprise announcement last week that the paper was shutting down. Tim is founder of 48 Hills, a progressive daily online paper. Dave Leventhal is senior political reporter for the Center for Public Integrity, and Mike Doyle is legal affairs correspondent for McClatchy Newspaper. He also covers California politics. And if you'd like to express your reaction to the closure of the San Francisco Bay Guardian, what do you think it brought to the community, and what are your thoughts now that it's going away? And also, we're going to talk about the future of alternative weeklies. Also closing last week, the Phoenix Providence and the Knoxville Tennessee. And so we'll talk more about that. So what alternative weekly do you have in your area? And what kind of news do you get from an alternative weekly that you might not get from your local paper? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And that paper in Knoxville is called Knoxville's Metro, out of Knoxville, Tennessee. What about the economics of alternative weeklies, Tim?
Well, it's a challenge. I mean, alt weeklies live on advertising. All newspapers really live on advertising. I mean, the dollar you spend on the Chronicle barely pays for someone to go put the papers in the machine and collect the quarters and add them up. It's an advertising game. And, you know, we were doing really well with classified ads for a while and personal ads. And then Craigslist, of course, and online took those away. And, you know, for a while, we were doing really well with medical marijuana ads. And then the U.S. Attorney for Northern California cracked down on medical marijuana, and that went away. So, you know, it seemed like the entire time I was at The Guardian, there was always ups and downs. We'd discover some new type of advertising that nobody else was doing. And personal ads were one of those. No one else was doing that. The alternative weeklies all over the country made it a franchise, and then somebody else grabbed it. So it's always been a challenge. But the economics of the business are you have to sell enough ads to pay your staff. And, you know, when Bruce was owned the paper and I was running it, that was really our goal. I mean, The Guardian was never out to make vast profits. The idea was to make enough money to pay the staff to do a really good job. And I think that's changing with the entire newspaper industry now. I mean, every print newspaper in the country is having challenges, in part because print's expensive. You have to pay for a press and press operators, and then distribution's expensive. You have to, once you've got those papers in a big stack, you have to pay somebody to take them all around to all the distribution points. You have to buy and maintain news racks. It's an expensive operation, and as the advertising declines, it gets tougher and tougher.
Mike, what are your thoughts on this as a reporter with McClatchy? The Modesto Bee is owned by McClatchy. The Fresno Bee here in California is owned by McClatchy. What about the economics of your paper?
Well, now you're going to make me cry because, like every chain, McClatchy has retrenched dramatically. Here in the Washington Bureau, we've remained relatively steady in terms of employment. But roughly speaking, the 29 McClatchy papers, and there used to be 30, the 29 McClatchy daily papers, I believe, have shrunk in terms of personnel by about a third over the last 5 or 6 years. Mm. The papers are thinner. The news hole is smaller. The resources are less available to do the great reporting that I think McClatchy's always been known for. McClatchy's a great chain, and I love it dearly, and I think we're doing better than many in terms of a continued commitment. Certainly in Washington, D.C., we've got an amazingly strong commitment in the face of the plague that's wiped out every newspaper around us. So it's great. I'm filled with trepidation when I look at the future of the industry. And just recently, just yesterday, the third quarter earnings were reported, and there's a continued decline in advertising. And like Tim points out, you need the advertising revenues in order to pay people to put out the product, and advertising revenues continue to shrink in the face of competition.
Tim?
Yeah, I just want to add a note to that, because we all feel that way in the newspaper industry. And I teach journalism, and my students all say, gee, is there any future for this business? And the upbeat note I want to throw out here for everybody to understand is that democracy cannot survive without reporters. Mm. You have to have journalists. And, you know, it may be that over the next 20 years, the delivery method changes, and that we are not killing trees, we're using electrons on a screen, and that we are distributing our news in a different way. But there have to be reporters going out and covering what's going on. You cannot cover the Affordable Care Act debate from your couch with a laptop. You have to be in Washington, D.C. You have to be talking to people. You have to be doing what the McClatchy Bureau does. You have to go out there and cover, and you have to have investigative reporters. So because I believe that is so essential to democracy, to our system of government, I believe firmly that those models are going to emerge, and I don't know exactly what they are. My model is nonprofit community-supported journalism. 48hills.org is a nonprofit, and we are raising money from the community the same way KALW does. But other models will emerge, and they're going to have to. And it's going to be very different from what we see today. The days of the giant, dominant one newspaper in a city are going away. But in place of it, maybe in 10 years, we'll see half a dozen online daily newspapers in San Francisco, none of them with a staff of 200, but all of them with a staff of 10. I don't know what the model is going to be, but I'm not prepared to say it's the death of journalism because we can't survive without it.
Right. Well, and Dave, in the case of the Center for Public Integrity, this nonprofit is funded by some major foundations. And you all do really incredible work, specifically on money and politics. You've got a bunch of stories just on the last 2 weeks. Controversial Republican telemarketer form super PAC, secret politics pervade popular companies. Lots of stories about money and politics right now. So what about the Center for Public Integrity's funding model? Do you see this working for the near future?
I certainly do, and I've chosen to work for a nonprofit news organization because I believe certainly in the one that I'm working for, but in many other nonprofit news organizations, the future of journalism does, at least in part, lie here. You have the ability as a reporter to do some of the best work of your career. We won a Pulitzer Prize for investigative reporting in 2014 for a project that took about 18 months to write and report and finally publish. But it's not us. There's ProPublica. I mentioned the Texas Tribune earlier, MinnPost in Minnesota. There's news publications in almost every state right now that take on the nonprofit model. So sometimes where there's destruction, there's also creation. And many nonprofit news organizations, some very large, but also some very small, are doing incredible work right now because they've had buy-in, not only by big foundations that do a lot of funding for these types of organizations, but also average people who just support good journalism, who want to read good journalism, who have a thirst for investigative or enterprising journalism that they can't necessarily get in other realms where perhaps they used to, or they can't get as much of it. So there's definitely another upbeat note, I think, to strike is that there is great journalism being done today that even 5 years ago just simply didn't exist because the news organizations that are doing it either didn't exist or don't exist in the form that they're in now.
Yeah, I'd like to echo that idea of creative destruction leading to new opportunities. Just recently, there's a concept called journalism deeply. I don't know the individuals behind it, but they put together Ebola deeply, and the idea is that it aggregates and also initiates in-depth journalism on a topic of international significance. Earlier, there was a Syria deeply. I don't know the funding model. I don't know if it's advertising driven or not, but it's a remarkable notion that it's a one-stop shop for smart journalism on a given topic in which people can dig in really deeply. And that's all initiated in the wake of the destruction of the legacy media. So there really are some great opportunities out there.
Tim?
Yeah, well, that's what I'm trying to do locally. I mean, I decided when I not entirely voluntarily left The Guardian, that it was time to try something different and to see if we could do community-supported journalism in San Francisco. And so far, it's working out. I mean, I wish I had enough money to hire a great big staff. But when I look around the country, I see a lot of exciting things happening mm-hmm. in different and new models. And that's what I'm hoping for. I'm hoping that as the legacy daily newspapers continue in their decline, which is sad, all of us in the... I mean, I still love to pick up the San Francisco Chronicle in the morning and the New York Times and sit there and page through them. Mm-hmm. I still love print. But as a journalism teacher, I also know that my students don't. That, basically people who are under 30 don't read print. And in fact, a lot of people under 40 don't read print, right? So the model is changing. But just because the delivery method is changing, it doesn't mean that the mission is changing. That we still are about going out and finding news, and as investigative reporters, finding news that no one else has got and processing it and delivering it.
And that's Tim Redmond, former SF Bay Guardian editor and founder of 48 Hills. We're talking about the future of alternative weeklies, and we'd love to hear from you. We'll be back after this.
Lots of ways to join in today's conversation. You can send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. There's a toll-free number as well, 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. Coming up at 11 on the BBC's World Have Your Say, more on Ebola. On the one hand, fresh outbreaks in Mali and New York. On the other, progress towards a vaccination. That's the BBC and World Have Your Say, coming up at 11. We'll be right back.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we will continue our conversation about money and politics with Lawrence Lessig, Harvard professor and co-founder of Mayday, a super PAC fighting big money in politics. Is it possible for a super PAC to get money out of politics? What will it take to pass campaign finance reform? We'll talk about efforts across the country and where are politicians talking about this issue. And then on Tuesday, we will have a conversation about a new forthcoming documentary, Virunga. It is a true story of a group of people risking their lives to build a better future in a part of Africa that the world has mostly forgotten, and a gripping expose of the realities of life in the Congo. That's on Tuesday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it's our media roundtable, the day we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. We've been talking about the closure of the San Francisco Bay Guardian and the future of alternative weeklies. If you'd like to tell us about an alternative weekly in your area and stories that it covers that maybe you don't get from your local paper or local television news, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Today, we're joined by Tim Redmond. He spent 31 years at the San Francisco Bay Guardian. He is the founder of 48 Hills, a progressive online newspaper where you can read investigative reporting and also reporting about arts and culture. Dave Leventhal is senior political reporter with the Center for Public Integrity, a nonprofit news outlet that's funded by foundations. And Mike Doyle is legal affairs correspondent in the D.C. Bureau of McClatchy. They publish the Fresno Bee, the Sacramento Bee, and the Modesto Bee. Mike also covers California politics. And let's hear from Ken in San Francisco. Hi, Ken. Welcome to the show.
Hey, good morning. Two quick questions. But first, I'd like to say that the disappearance of journalists is why interviewers and broadcasts should always be hard-hitting to their guests, because there's no one else to do the investigations anymore. So my question is, there is a rumor floating around that about 10, 15 years ago, Craigslist approached all the local newspapers in San Francisco to ask if they could take over their classifieds. And everyone said no, and then we know what happened next. So that's question one. And then question two is, as a business model, since all the online news sites take articles from each other and reprint things, why isn't the original journalist who wrote the article a newspaper, why aren't they paid each time the piece is reprinted or cribbed or stolen or whatever?
All right, thanks, Ken.
Two good questions. Craig Newmark did not come to me at the Bay Guardian and ask to take over our classifieds. In fact, I cornered him at a conference a few years after he started and basically said the exact same thing. Why don't you work with us instead of trying to put us out of business? He wasn't interested. He was doing his own thing. I said, Craig, you're not producing any content. The money that you make doesn't go to pay reporters to do stories. And in fact, for Craigslist outside of San Francisco, that money all gets sucked out of the local community. Why don't you go work with the alternative newspapers? And he said he wasn't interested. So I don't think that rumor, at least it wasn't in my case. Your second point is a very good one, and I think everyone in journalism wonders about that. All of these content aggregator sites, they take my work or your work or whoever else's work, and they basically, they don't reprint it, but they link to it, which is great because it brings us traffic, and then they comment on it and so forth. And I don't know if we're ever going to find a model where people get paid for that, I guess, like musicians do through ASCAP and BMI. It would be kind of hard to do. But I do think that it raises a very important point, which is if the original reporter, the person who actually went out and did that work, isn't around, what are the blogs going to have to reprint? I mean, everybody criticizes, the New York Times and the MSM, the mainstream media, gets trashed in a lot of these. But for example, if you go to Daily Coast, which is a big national news site, a significant amount of what is on there comes from the MSM. There's a reporter somewhere right at the New York Times who does a story, and then everyone at Daily Coast talks about it. Nothing wrong with that. I'm good with that. I think it's fine. But we have to remember, if someone's not paying that New York Times reporter to go out and do that investigative work, it isn't going to happen.
Dave or Mike, do you have any comments on this?
Well, I wish I got royalties for the story of mine
picked
up by the aggregating sites. But I'm frankly conflicted because as Tim kind of suggested, there is benefit to having a story linked, a reputational benefit. You get into wider circulation, sources will open up, and so, I mean, it's entirely beyond my power to try to compel payment for my work besides the intellectual properties owned by McClatchy. It's not mine to begin with. But I'm mollified for my lack of outside payment to a degree by the fact of increasing outside visibility.
All right. Well, thank you again for calling in, Ken. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. We're going to talk now about money in politics. The midterms are expected to be the most expensive. We always break records nowadays. $4 billion on this upcoming election. And we're also going to talk about voter ID laws across the country, the latest in Texas, the strictest in the nation. So if you'd like to talk about coverage of money in politics, where are you going to follow the money? We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. How do you think these issues are being covered? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So there's a ton of money being spent on propositions in California. We're voting on five on Election Day, November 4th. And then in towns across the state of California, there's a bunch of elections. In San Francisco, there's 11. So we have a total of 16. Who can keep up with this? But when you look at the national spending, Dave, once again, we're going to break records. $4 billion. What really stands out for you this time around?
What stands out this time around is two things. Number one, the dollar figure itself, which will exceed $4 billion just in federal races alone, saying nothing about state-level races, gubernatorial races, et cetera, but also, too, just the rank negativity in some of these races. We did an analysis just this week that showed in many key Senate races that are going to determine likely whether Republicans or Democrats control the Senate, sometimes 90, 95%, even almost 100% of the thousands of television ads over the course of just a single week have a negative tone to them, are attacked ads, are going after a candidate as opposed to promoting a candidate. And likewise, too, along with that, these are not advertisements that are necessarily coming from the candidates themselves. Sometimes not even the majority are coming from the candidates themselves. They're coming from super PACs and politically active nonprofit organizations, all these different types of outside groups that now have the ability to raise and spend unlimited amounts of money and pump it into Senate, House, whatever kinds of elections they want to. And just a final note on that as well is that when this all happens, it happens really a degree that it never could before, simply because of the changes in federal law that make it so. So as a voter in any of these states where this is all happening, your eyeballs are pretty much burning because it's happening at a pitched level that is really unprecedented in U.S. history for some of these individual races.
Democrats and their supporters and PACs have aired around 6,000 ads, and Republicans have aired around 10,000 ads. According to the Center for Public Integrity, spending on TV ads soars to $119 million ahead of Election Day. Do you think the media are doing a good job of telling voters what's actually true and what's not in these ads?
There's a lot of excellent fact-checking operations that do. Now, some states in their local races don't have reporters who are necessarily doing fact checks all the time. At the national level, perhaps it's a little bit better. But what's happening now is not isolated to just Republicans or just Democrats. Both sides have, in a full-throated, warm embrace kind of a way, taken on the mantle of big money in politics. Both sides are operating super PACs. Both sides are operating politically active nonprofit groups. The conservatives were very much out of the gate and at the forefront of this a couple of years ago, but the Democrats and the liberals, simply out of necessity, have largely caught up to where the Republicans are in the 2014 election cycle. In some races, they're spending more money, the Democrats and in liberal side of the equation, than the Republican and conservative side of the operation. So we've talked to a lot of voters. Many of them are just very frustrated. This is conservatives and liberals alike who would like some alternative solution to all of this. They just simply don't like the state of play in politics right now as it comes to the way that elections are run. At the same time, the people who are in office right now are the ones who are running, and very few of them seem to have much of an appetite to do anything differently, or certainly anything that would give their opponent a potential advantage in future elections.
Tim, we've got 5 important ballot measures in California, 11 in San Francisco, lots of money at the state level. I've been hearing radio ads constantly, mostly on Prop 45.
Yes, which Prop 45 and Prop 46.
Yeah. And so it would allow the insurance commissioner to, you know, basically say, Blue Shield, you have no justification for raising these rates, so you're not going to do it. And so the healthcare industry, we had a debate about this, is spending about $45 million on Prop 45. Do you think reporters are doing a good job of, first of all, giving voters the information they need about the props and then fact-checking the ads?
In a short, to put it simply, no. I don't see enough of that going on in California or in San Francisco at all, looking at those ads and saying, what's really behind this? And also, who is really behind this?
Right.
Just laying out, this is the health insurance industry on one side and consumer advocates on others. I mean, you know, just telling people who's really spending this money and what they have to gain from it is a very, very significant thing. And I don't see enough fact-checking of these ads. It's, you know, the average person who has not done their own research listens to this stuff, watches this stuff on TV, and walks away completely boggled and completely confused. Because we're not. I mean, you know, you've had people on and tried to do this, and other radio stations have, and some media are trying very hard to do this. But I think because of the preponderance of this vast amount of money, a lot of the voters are going to be completely confused.
And we're having a debate on Prop 46 next Wednesday. We've already had a debate on Prop 1, 45, and 47, and you can find those archived at yourcallradio.org. Mike, before we dive in and talk about voter ID laws, what are your thoughts on the state of reporting on propositions? It can be so overwhelming, and then fact-checking these ads.
Well, 2 points. One is I think that there are excellent fact-checking sites, PolitiFact, which is franchise itself. It's impossible to stay even with the swarm of ads, so you're constantly chasing after them. I think the media does a good job. I would draw attention to another sub-chapter in the political spending arena. Political spending per se, I don't decry it. That's just raw political speech, and the answer to it is more speech. In the area of judicial campaigns, it can be more troublesome. There are millions of dollars being spent on statewide judicial campaigns, and a very interesting study this week from the American Constitution Society found that there was a positive correlation between judicial campaign ads and votes against a criminal appeal. In other words, judges are so afraid of having a negative ad run against them when they face a retention election, they are more likely to vote against a criminal appeal, even if it has merit. So just for listeners, I'd say pay attention in addition to political campaign spending. There's a lot of money being spent at the state judicial level, and that is tilting justice.
And if I could just echo that, Rose, real quickly, we've been finding the exact same thing, not only with state judicial campaigns, but certainly ballot measures. We had a piece out this week that dipped into just some of the huge corporate interests that have been getting involved in ballot initiative votes in ways that we've never seen before, even with very expensive ballot initiative campaigns that have happened in recent years. California is ground zero for ballot initiatives among states, but this is really new territory and some new ground that's being turned here, and ballot measures, they're not the sexiest things in the world, particularly compared to campaigns where a real live human being is running against a real live human being. We're talking about things that don't live and breathe here, but are going to affect living and breathing people in a major, major way, and corporations and other huge special interests are very much taking notice of that and shoveling in incredible amounts of money to try to sway the outcome of those particular votes.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and these ballot measures sure do affect our lives. Since this is new territory, can you give us an example, since it's not getting much media attention?
Absolutely. There's a number of large corporate interests in California and several other states that have ballot initiatives have gone into the 7, even 8 figures in terms of the money that they are putting in and investing in these initiatives. So without getting too deep into the weeds, it's something that just when you compare it to past election cycles, the 2014 election cycle stands alone and stands apart from the previous ones.
That is Dave Leventhal, senior political reporter with the Center for Public Integrity. Mike Doyle is a legal affairs correspondent in the D.C. Bureau of McClatchy. McClatchy owns the Sacramento Bee, the Fresno Bee, and the Modesto Bee. Mike also covers California politics. And Tim Redmond is former San Francisco Bay Guardian editor and founder of 48 Hills, a progressive online daily newspaper. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. Where are you going for coverage of this election? Again, we're voting November 4th. There's been a little confusion because some voting envelopes have said November 5th. It's November 4th in 11 days. And there are five state propositions. We've done debates on almost all of them. You can find the archive at yourcallradio.org. Let's talk about the voter ID law in Texas. You've been covering this, Mike. Your lead says a divided Supreme Court early Saturday morning just let a new Texas voter ID law take effect, the latest ruling in a series of decisions on voting laws in the states just weeks before the midterm election. Now, in Texas, some forms of ID are accepted. Gun licenses will be accepted, but college photo IDs will not be accepted. What is the rationale behind that?
The stated rationale, as in every state that has adopted new voter ID laws, is to prevent voter fraud. The fanciful notion, is that people are using fake IDs to get in and vote. That idea has been pretty much obliterated by every study that's been done. There's a judge, a conservative Republican appointee named Richard Posner, who's out in the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, which is in the Midwest, and he has wrote several opinions in which he said that it is a bogus notion to think that voter ID laws are in reality designed to stop voter fraud, because voter fraud doesn't exist at the fake ID level. He said that the frank and obvious purpose is to suppress voter outcome. That's a judge speaking. But to return to the argument, the Texas state argument is that by requiring a photo ID, you're rooting out a possible fraudulent voter.
Well, back to the fraud, though, because this is really the rationale for voter ID laws. And the Washington Post just had a piece, 7 papers, 4 government inquiries, 2 news investigations, and 1 court ruling proving voter fraud is mostly a myth. So, Tim, if a politician says we need these laws for voter fraud, how should a reporter respond?
What voter fraud? Point to the voter fraud. What I always do, you know, as a journalist, when a politician comes forward with a proposal, is I always first ask, what is the problem we're trying to solve here? What is wrong that we need this law to fix? And a lot of times there are things that are very wrong. But I want to know first what the problem is. What is the problem we're trying to solve with voter fraud? I think pretty much everyone agrees there isn't a problem. And I think it's actually pretty clear on its face what this is about. It's about suppressing the votes of certain people. It's about trying to ensure in Texas that minority voters, that African-American voters, that Latino voters, and that young voters, since they don't accept college IDs, are not going to the polls in as large numbers, and that older, white, and presumably more conservative voters are going to be voting. I mean, you know, every politician would love to choose their own electorate, and they try by gerrymandering their districts. This is even worse. This is gerrymandering districts on steroids. It's basically saying we're going to take an entire state and gerrymander who's going to show up and vote. That's what this is about.
Well, as of October 13th of this year, 31 voter ID laws are in force across this country. And the reporting on voter fraud has sort of become a tale of he said, she said, and it's framed as a matter of fact. New York Times public editor Margaret Sullivan says she's received so many complaints from readers saying that this is a false equivalency. And she wrote, quote, when there's significant evidence on a hot topic, whether it's voting fraud or the reality of climate change, the Times should not shy away from stating it simply and clearly, end quote. So, Mike, is there any sort of policy at McClatchy on something like voter fraud? How do you think reporters should deal with it?
It's tricky. Our policy is to write stories fairly, accurately, and neutrally, and that does potentially lead to the problem of a false equivalency. It's far be it from me, in my view, to say the Texas legislature, in an obvious move to suppress minority and Democratic voters, passed a voter ID law. I have to, in my view, and I think a common journalism view, is let each side take its view. Now, I would again commend listeners to the work of Richard Posner. Posner, a judge, a very smart man, and a Republican appointee, said there's a positive correlation between states that pass voter ID laws and states that have a Republican governor and a Republican legislature. He just flat out says these are Republican measures designed to suppress Democratic votes. I can quote him prominently, but I'm not an editorial writer, and I need to keep my own neutrality at the forefront. So I'm not going to be the reporter that calls the Texas legislature racist. I'll let somebody else do that for me.
Tim?
I actually think that lead you just read aloud sounded great. That's what I would have written. And I think really, we obviously have different views of how to do journalism, and McClatchy has different policies than 48hills.org does, obviously. But I do think that the New York Times public editor is right. I think that there's certain times that, with all due respect to objectivity and neutrality, there's certain times that the case is so clear that you have to come out and say, you know, I've always told my reporters, there's at least two sides to every story, but they're not both right. And sometimes what I think the job of a reporter is to get out there and tell people, yeah, there's two sides to the story, but I have researched this and examined this in great depth, and both sides are not right. One side is right and one side is wrong. And I do think that as journalists, sometimes we owe the public that.
Dave, before we go to a call, any policies at Center for Public Integrity on this issue?
We definitely want to be neutral in everything that we do and seek both sides, but we're seeking the truth of the matter, too. We take very, very data-based approaches to many of our stories, use a lot of facts and use a lot of figures and analytical work to reach a conclusion as to whether something is correct, whether something is valid. So whether it was voting ID laws, we've been much more focused on the money than this particular legal issue, but regardless of what we write about, that's the approach that we want to take. But I should also note, too, that don't expect this issue to go away anytime soon. Both Democrats and Republicans are really hot on it. Whether this is an issue or not an issue, both of them are spending a whole lot of time and effort fundraising off this issue. So do not be surprised if you are a Democrat or a Republican, if you get a fundraiser solicitation in your inbox or in your mailbox talking about this issue as a way to fight against the other side because the other side's bad.
Well, and also it's going to be really interesting to watch what goes down in Texas because the polls are open now. We've got early voting. And I just read that there were more voters who turned out for the first day of early voting in Texas than ever before in history. And a lot of reports say that is due to Governor Wendy Davis and her grassroots teams on the ground really getting the vote out. And so it's going to see how that plays out, and then this voter ID law now in Texas.
Right, and there may be a backlash. It may be that Democrats in Texas are saying, well, they can't push us around and encourage us not to vote with these voter ID laws. We're going to have a backlash and go out in great numbers.
Yeah.
You know, we don't know.
And Wendy Davis is running for governor on the Democratic ticket in Texas. Let's go to a few callers. Let's hear from Pat in San Francisco. Hi, Pat. Hello, Pat. Let's try Art in San Francisco. Hi, Art.
Hi, Rose. Thanks very much for another great program. A question for Tim. For those of us who really love the Bay Guardian and whatever representative the work it does or it did, is there a place on your 48 Hills blog, or is there another place online where we can engage in a conversation to help think about how we might fill that void here in San Francisco?
Well, that's one of the things that I'm trying to do, is partially to the extent that I can fill that void and also have that conversation. And I would encourage you to go to 48 Hills and talk about that. I mean, we have a very lively comment section. I want this to be a forum for debate. It's tricky. I don't know. I mean, the Guardian staff is talking about trying to find a buyer. I don't know if someone is going to come along with the... It would take significant deep pockets. It would take someone with a bunch of money who would be willing to invest in it to bring the Guardian back to life. And if not, if that doesn't happen, then, you know, I and those of us who care about progressive alternative media are going to try very, very hard to do it in a different forum.
All right. Thank you, Art. We have an email from Michael. I just downloaded the Bay Guardian's endorsements for the upcoming election, as I have for many years. And when I fill in my absentee ballot with the Guardian's help, I hope the employees find a way to keep it going. Yes, thank you. There is a slate from the Guardian for this upcoming election.
Yeah, one of the great public services the Guardian always offered was doing election endorsements that were And I say this as somebody who worked really, really hard on this for 31 years, exceptionally well researched. We put a vast amount of time and effort into our election endorsements, which you could agree with or disagree with, but they were well researched. So that's a huge gap.
Well, we're almost out of time. I'd like to know what you're all working on. Tim Redmond?
Well, what I'm working on is trying to make sense of the upcoming election in San Francisco and in California, but mostly I'm looking at San Francisco, where we're seeing tremendous amounts. We're seeing on a microcosm the same thing we're seeing on a national level. There are two tech titans, two wealthy tech investors, who are together putting more than $500,000 into an independent expenditure campaign in just one assembly district. I mean, they've spent more than $500,000 attacking Supervisor David Campos in the 17th Assembly District. And that's just two people. I mean, we're basically looking at two folks deciding that they can tell you who you want to elect to the assembly. So I'm trying to sort this all out and make sense of that.
And on November 5th, we're going to do a post-election show to look at the results. So we'll definitely look for that, Tim. Thank you. What about you, Dave? What are you working on?
We were up until about 3 in the morning last night, my colleague Michael Beckel and I working on a piece, the lead of which is the days of candidates dominating their own political campaigns are over. It's running on the Daily Beast right now, just went up this hour, and also publicintegrity.org, and it really dives into how outside political groups, super PACs, nonprofits, political committees in many races, U.S. Senate races across the country, are bigger players than the candidates themselves in their own races. And we use a variety of data sources to underscore that and use that as a foundation, but also talk to a lot of folks who have interests in both sides of the matter.
Wow. Well, thank you for that, for sure. And Mike, what about you? What are you working on?
Well, I'm putting on my volunteer firefighter EMT hat, and I'll be doing a piece looking at the medics who are on the front lines in the fight against Ebola and checking on how well prepared they are, how protocols and operating procedures have changed, and whether the fire EMS first responders are up to the task of meeting the Ebola patients that are coming.
Wow, thank you. Mike Doyle is a reporter in the D.C. Bureau of McClatchy, covering legal affairs and California politics. Dave Leventhal, senior political reporter with the Center for Public Integrity. Tim Redmond, former editor of the San Francisco Bay Guardian and founder of 48 Hills. Thank you all for joining us.
Of course, happy to be here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rose.
And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. Is it possible for a super PAC to get money out of politics? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with Lawrence Lessig, Harvard professor and co-founder of Mayday, a super PAC fighting big money in politics. He says Congress will never be able to solve problems until money doesn't rule. So what will it take to pass campaign finance reform? And where are politicians talking about this issue? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Becca Hoekstra produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. We'll be right back.